Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
It's good to read different opinions, because if you're reading different opinions, then you can decide what angle you can use to formulate a joke. If you don't know what other people are saying, you don't know what's on the other side of that coin, how can you make a joke about it?
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Balancing Acts. In this conversation, I talk to TV comedy writer Christine Rose. Perfect. Hello, I'm Steve Whiteley and welcome to Balancing Acts, a series of conversations with an array of creatives. We talk about their journey, the struggles they faced whilst progressing their career, strategies they use to unlock their creativity, how they balance their career with their personal lives, what impact this has had on their mental health, and lots more. If you have watched Graham Norton's show, Jonathan Ross show, Chatty Man, Have I Got News For You, 8 out of 10 Cats, Would I Lie To You, Roast Battle, Horrible Histories, then you will most definitely have heard and seen some of Christine's work. She's also written on a ton of award shows, including the BAFTAs, the Brits, Royal Variety, as well as reality TV shows, dating shows, survival shows. She won TV Best Comedy Writer in the 2020 Funny Women Awards and has worked on loads and loads of shows. So it was fantastic talking to Christine about her journey, how she's got to where she's got to in her career and the shifts that have or have not changed during her career in terms of inclusion and diversity and lots more. So yeah, this is, you may have noticed that there was a gap, and this is the first episode in about 3 weeks or so, maybe a bit longer. And that's partly to do with I had an accident and a Uber driver hit me while I was on a bicycle, cycling. And I went to A&E. It was all good, but I've had to slow down a little bit. I'm fine. I didn't have any life-changing moments. I didn't see the bright light or anything like that. I didn't get to have a review of my life. And I don't think I've come away with any life-changing thoughts, except for that I should probably wear a helmet next time I'm cycling at night and not have a couple of margaritas before I get on my bike. I mean, it was a 5-minute cycle home. I thought it would be fine. So that's partly why we haven't had as many episodes as of late, but I am jumping back on the podcast horse. Also, in terms of audio ambience, the Blue Yeti mic, my faithful Blue Yeti, was in my bag upon the collision and might also have got busted up like me. So I'm currently using the internal mic. You don't need to know this, but I need to let you know because I'm just sharing with you guys. So I hope you enjoy this episode. And as always, if you like it, if you're enjoying the series, please do rate and review it on Apple. And that's it. So without further ado, over to Christine. Perfect. So you've done a lot in the course of your career as a TV writer. There's loads to cover. Why don't we just kick things off at the beginning. Sorry, yeah.
Hi,
yeah.
Steve.
In the last couple of years at the beginning. Talk me through, because I know you didn't, sort of from what I've read, you didn't intentionally
decide, you know, it wasn't a sort of thing right from the beginning. We're like, I'm going to be a TV writer, a gag writer. You kind of, it was a bit more casual. Is that right? You fell into it as opposed to setting out to do it.
Yeah, I didn't know it was a job.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew people wrote sitcoms, obviously. I knew that you could be a comedy writer in terms of, you know, writing sitcoms and comedies on TV. But I didn't really know that people had writers in terms of, you know, I never thought about it in terms of panel shows and chat shows and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And no one does, you know, most people don't think about it, because when you talk to the general public about it, they go, oh, I didn't really know that was a thing, or I didn't know they had writers, or, you know, it's sort of kept quite quiet here. Whereas in America, it's all, you know, thanks to my writers, I wouldn't be able to do this without my writers. Sorry about my accent. You know, and they're given awards, and they're, you know, they talk about it a lot, and nobody's ashamed of having a writer, and nobody tries to hide the fact that there's 20 writers on a chat show.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that is over here, that we don't do that and celebrate writers in the same way?
I don't know. I think there's less money, so there's less writers. So those writers have less power because there's no unions or anything. And so if people don't want to discuss it, the writers can't do anything. Whereas in America, there's so many writers, it'd be very difficult to keep them, you know, to sort of go, can we not really talk about this? Like on shows often, not often, but they went through a stage where it's happening more. They'll ask if you can be put down as production, a program associate rather than
writer. Yeah, I've seen that. What's that about?
That basically means there's a lot of writers on this show and we don't want it to look that written.
Right.
Or the host is uncomfortable with the fact that there's so many writers listed. So can we put you down as program associate, because you still get your credit, but it's sort of hidden in the smoke and mirrors as to what program associate is. So everyone's happy. The host and the show don't feel like people are going to go, oh, 20 writers on that show and I thought it was rubbish. You know, the host can still, you know, not look like they've had a million people giving them jokes, because it's a vicious circle. Because people don't understand how a television show is made and how long it takes to record, they'll watch half an hour, 28 minutes, whatever, 26 minutes, depending on the channel. And they won't see that many jokes necessarily, because a lot of it has come out in the edit. But that show took 2.5 hours to record. A lot of material was needed. So in their head, they're like, well, why would they need five writers? They didn't say that much. And that person's funny. People always go, I thought they were funny in their own right.
Yeah, go, yeah.
Of course they are. What are you talking about? You know, they forget how many years these stand-ups have had to travel the country, you know, becoming good enough that they get offered a TV show. You know, that's a big journey of them being funny. But once they get a show, they're also doing other things. You know, they're also doing maybe radio shows and other people's shows and, you know, podcasts and all sorts of other things. And, you know, on a show like Have I Got News For You, it will take 3 writing days and 3 writers a day on each day just to get enough material for the host. So imagine if the host had to do that by themselves.
Yeah, it's insane.
And they were also doing all the other things they do, you know, being actors, and it's just, the maths doesn't work. Of course they're going to need people to help them. Also, they can't use a lot of their stand-up material, because once they've said it on a TV show, it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, so they don't want to use all their live material on one episode of a television show. So that leaves them starting from, you know, zero in terms of, particularly if it's a topical show and it has to be written every week.
Yeah.
So the short answer is, I think people don't understand how television shows are made here. And so people don't want the public to think that they're not funny in their own right. And I don't know, really.
But does it frustrate you, you know, when you do get those people commenting saying, oh, I thought they were fun in their own right, and then, you know, combine that with maybe get credited as program associate, do you find it frustrating that you're not getting the, yeah, the acknowledgement to a certain degree? Is that frustrating? Because I know really what, you know, doing what you're doing, you're writing for that person, and it's actually, you know, you've got to be quite, yeah, it's egoless, isn't it? You're not really attached to your ego because you're creating this material, you're giving it to somebody else, and then they're performing that. But is there a sense of like, oh, it'd be nice to be acknowledged?
Sometimes. It depends, really. It depends on the show. It depends how much work you've put into the show. It depends how much of that, how much of the material that you've written got used.
Yeah.
It depends. Okay. I care less now. When you're starting out,
it means a lot more.
It means a lot more. Mm. Now, if someone wants to put me a program associate, I'm like, oh, whatever, I don't care. You know, I'll go and do something else.
Okay.
It doesn't bother me now. On a personal level, it doesn't bother me. But on an industry level, it does bother me because it's all colluding to hiding writers and making people feel bad about having them. And, you know, I just don't understand it because nobody feels bad in America about having writers. They encourage it. They celebrate it. Like I said, they, you know, it's seen as a it's known to be a job, and there are pathways to get in. And whereas here, it's all kind of shrouded in mystery. And yeah,
I don't mind not
being credited as a writer. It's fine.
Yeah,
but yeah, I think there should be a more of a push to sort of say this is something that happens, and maybe explain to people why it happens. You know, because it is unfair on the hosts as well, because they shouldn't be made to feel embarrassed for having writers, or that they shouldn't be made to feel that they're not funny enough to write it on their own, because it's impossible. It's just impossible.
Yeah.
And you know, Jimmy Fallon doesn't pretend that he stays up all night reading the newspapers. You know, he's got to host the show. He hasn't got time to sit in a room and go through newspapers and write topical jokes.
Yeah.
You know, he just hasn't got time to do that. There's too much material needed every single day.
Well, it's the same with like narrative and scripted shows in the US. You've got the showrunner and the creator, but he's got a whole team of, he's got a whole writer's room that are working on episodes. He can do it.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Things always get compared to America, but it's like the money there and the amount of people that they have is just, you know, they have someone to do everything. Whereas here, one person ends up doing five jobs. You know, people will be writers and producers and directors, and you know, jobs get rolled into one because there's not money to have 50 different people.
I've asked this question before on the podcast, but you know, seeing as we're on this topic, I wanted to ask you, knowing you know how bigger it is in the US and budgets and so forth, have you had you know, has there been inclination on your part to want to go over there and see if you can do what you're doing over there, based on the fact that you've got these bigger budgets, based on the fact that, you know, writers are credited in the right way, etc.?
I did spend a bit of time in New York. I was going out with someone who lived in New York, and we would travel back and forward. So I did spend a bit of time there, and I did talk to some people, and I spoke to an agent out there. Yeah, if I went out there, I think I could definitely, you know, get some work doing monologue stuff because I've got a lot of experience, and I've worked on big shows here that they know. I think that's a problem in America. They don't often know a lot of our shows.
Right, yeah.
But they do love British comedy. So I do think it would be something that... But I suppose the problem is, really, you need to go when you're younger. You need to go out there when you're 25 and be like, yeah. But I wasn't going to do that when I was 25 because, well, because I don't normally go, yeah. But also because you haven't got any experience then. So.
Yeah.
You haven't got the confidence to go out there and go, I can definitely do this. But by the time you get to the point where you're like, I can definitely do this, it's like, do I now want to move to another country? And the problem is, I think it's, you basically get staffed on a job in America. So you'll get staffed on one show and you will work on that show every day.
Mm.
So you'll be in, if you're doing monologue, you'll be in really early. You just work on that monologue every day. You don't have the variety that you have here, where Monday I'll be doing 8 out of 10 cats, Tuesday I'll be doing Have I Got News For You. You know, I like that variety, and it means that you can work all the time. You know, I have writer friends in America that if they're not staffed on a job, they're in trouble.
Yeah.
Because there's not really any middle ground. because they're obsessed with staffing people, because you've got to get on staff because you've got to have your insurance and you've got to have, you know, your that regular wage. Whereas here it doesn't really work like that. And I suppose I would worry that I would lose my place on a lot of shows.
Okay.
And you're totally replaceable. Mm. You know, there's new people coming in all the time. And if you've spent years making sure that you're a regular on shows and then you just get up and leave and go, you know. So I'm a worrier in that respect. I would think, am I just going to burn everything that you've
created up till now?
Created here to go to America and sit in a room and just churn out monologue jokes on the same show with 25-year-olds.
Yeah.
I've made that sound quite depressing, but do you know what I mean?
No, you didn't, because you added the year bit.
And also, I suppose I like the fact that a lot of comedy is in the detail, and I worry a bit that I would have to, you lose a bit of the detail when you go to America, because it's like you haven't got the back story of, like, you know, loads of shows that were in the 70s and 80s here that you can draw on, or product names. You know, what are the funniest crisps? I know what the funniest crisps are here. If you go to America, what are the funniest crisps? I don't know. I'd have to go. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
I've made that sound weird.
No, you've got to indulge. No, it's true. You've got to indulge in that whole US diet. It's much higher in cholesterol. So it's going to have a health impact as well.
I would get so fat. Every time I go to New York, I get fat.
Oh, same.
Anyway.
Not. It's like a kid in a candy store over there. It's like, oh yeah, I gotta go Cat's Deli and have myself the deluxe bagel for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yeah. It's like sometimes I'll look at their monologue jokes and I think I could definitely write that joke. That makes complete sense to me. And other times I'll look at one of their monologue jokes and I'll think, I don't understand any of the words in that sentence. It will involve the NFL.
Right, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's tough. It's
minor celebrities that I've never heard of. Mm. You know, minor politicians.
Yeah.
But you think, well, I only know the big ones. I don't know who this guy is. You know,
it's very true. I didn't think about
that. That's where I worry as well, that I'd be like, I would lose a lot of what I'm good at because I haven't got that detail.
Mm.
But I mean, there's part of it that sounds to me quite exciting. There's another part of me that goes, I can't be bothered. I do not have I don't feel that I've got anything to prove anymore.
That's great. So
I sort of feel like I'm lucky. I've got a really good job.
Yeah.
And I can, you know, do it full time. Mm. Do I want to potentially set fire to that? Because some people have this thing in their head that you know, it's going to be better working on TV in America. And I don't necessarily agree with that.
Yeah, what's this shiny thing, isn't it, over there?
Yeah, and they do have more money. That's for sure. Mm. But does that mean that your working day is going to be better? You know, you're going to be up really early. You're going to be in there really early churning out these monologue jokes. And I don't know. Is that going to be more fun than sitting with my friends writing jokes about Susie Dent on Cat's Does Countdown? I don't know.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, and I'm not sure their quality of eggs are quite as high as over here. I mean, depending on where you're buying them, not sure.
They've got different farming practices.
They very much so, very much so. I recently had dinner. I was invited to. I'm trying.
Glad you're eating, Steve. Yeah, worried about you.
Yeah, no, it's just it was a dinner, and I don't really eat chicken so much anymore, but I did indulge on this occasion, and it was it's supposedly like the good chicken, not the bad chicken. And then I was like, oh, what's the difference between the good and the bad chicken? And somebody said, and then I remembered I watched this documentary. I said, oh yeah, no, the bad chicken is like they pump them up with all this shit because they want to get them fatter. And then the problem is they get so fat that their legs break. Yeah. And it's like, it's really horrendous for the chickens. It's very painful. You know, it's a much darker practice, you know, and unethical than, you know, the more organic stuff. And then just sort of everyone went silent and just looked down at their plate of chicken. Like, yeah, no, I probably shouldn't have said that right then. But this is the good chicken, so it's okay. It's okay. you got a picture moment.
But also, a lot of the documentaries that people have watched about meat practices?
No, we'll go with that, yeah.
So let's say meat practices. are American and they have a completely different system and different rules and different laws. And a lot of the stuff that happens there doesn't happen here.
No,
if you buy really good grass-fed meat from small farms, my dad was a vet. I can't go vegan. I've tried. My body doesn't process pulses very well.
Yeah.
And you need to. You're going to get your protein from your lentils and your chickpeas. I just can't. My body cannot break them down.
And you've got to eat a lot more of them. You've got to eat a lot more of your protein.
Yeah, you've got to get your protein. And people are always going about the plant, or you can get it from plants, plant protein. Yeah, you can. But if you can't break down legumes,
you're not going to be writing jokes.
You're just a big bloated ball of air wandering around. Who's this bloated woman? Sorry, I can't break down the legumes. You know, people need different diets. Some people need to eat meat. Some people are better without meat, you know. So I don't believe in this pushing one diet on everybody. I think you need to.
I agree. I did try it. I did it, and now I'm a bit more relaxed with it.
Yeah.
So back to the writing shenanigans.
We've gone down the cul-de-sac, Steve.
Yeah, a vegan cul-de-sac. So as we said before, you didn't intend to start off in a TV writing career. How did that come about?
So I was working when I was at university. I had various jobs working in pubs and things, and I would meet lots of people being a barmaid, and I would speak to people that work in TV, and you know, I would always think, oh, you know, I'd love to do that. It just sounds like really exciting, fun thing to do. And I remember the White Book. I don't know if this still exists. It was like it was called the White Book, and it was a directory of production companies.
Okay.
So I remember getting that and writing to as many production companies in there as I could to try and get a job as a runner. And I was doing part of my degree was sociology, and I remember them saying, when you send out surveys, you generally get a 10% response rate. And that's literally what I got. I think I sent out about 100 letters and I got 10 responses. And they were all, no, thank you. Yeah. Hello, no, thank you. Bye-bye. And I was like, oh, okay. And I didn't know anybody, you know, other than chatting to random people that came into the bar where I worked, didn't know anybody in TV. So I was like, oh, what do I do now? And I was finishing my degree and I didn't want to move out of London. So I was like, I've got to get a job. And then my flatmate's friend had just got a job working for a design company, and they were doing opening and closing titling sort of stuff, sort of mm-hmm. design. Like, and I was like, oh, that's sort of TV in a way, sort of graphics, basically TV graphics. And I was like, okay. So they were looking for a receptionist. So I ended up going to work there, and I was sort of their runner really / receptionist. It was a startup company, so it was really good fun. You know, it was proper Nathan Barley. It was Shoreditch. It was like just sort of Old Street, Clerkenwell Road sort of area. You know, people skateboarding through the office. It was classic, and it was fun. Everyone was young and starting out. They were doing sort of idents for TV. They did the Channel 4 ride. Remember the 4 that used to spin around?
I used to love that one, yeah.
But they did that. They did various other adverts, and, you know, it was just a cool place to work. And I would just answer the phones and, you know, just go and get toilet roll and go to the shop for people, go and get coffees, mm-hmm. you know, just dog's body stuff, but fun. And then they started to change into like a games company, an interactive games company. And I started to sort of work on the games side of things. And it turned into this company called Play Jam, which was games that you would play on your remote control through your set-top box. We didn't have Sky had Sky GameStar. And they, because they were Sky, they had a load of money, so they could buy in big names. So they would buy in like Disney character, you know, and like they would pay to use Shrek and stuff like that to make all these games. And we couldn't do any of that because we didn't have the money. So we had to make the games funny. We had to make them entertaining and funny, but without, you know, the lure of any big character names or anything. So we just used to have fun with it. yeah, the, all the games needed text, and the screens, the, all the loading screens needed sort of, you know, to push you to go and play another game or to advertise games. Games needed strap lines and fun things.
So it was like your training ground. That was like your writing training ground without even knowing it.
Oh, well, I suppose so. Yeah. I mean, it was a good, they sort of let you sort of in a way, just be quite creative and not do what you want, obviously. But, you know, if you came up with this, we had this game called Boy Racer, and the strap line was Trevor Your Engines. And, you know, it's just sort of just silly little things that we found funny. And yeah, they would just let us put it on screen. But eventually they sold it to Open TV, American company. And yeah, the fun started to stop then. It started to become a lot more corporate, and there was a lot less messing around, a lot more, how are we going to make money, serious money out of this? And we were like, oh, we're just having a laugh. And I suppose then I started to think, I really don't like the corporate world. The fun is going out of this. And now I have to be in meetings. I'm pretty straightforward. Like, I'll say what I think. And that sort of business thing where you can't say what you think, you have to sort of shroud it in business lingo.
Doesn't work well.
I just can't do it.
Yeah.
I'm not good at it. And I would end up just in conflict with people because I didn't really understand that you had to use the business, I have to put the business speak hat on.
Yeah.
And I just thought, this is not my world. I can't do it. And the company was basically changing, and they were making people redundant. So I was one of the people that got made redundant. So I was like, it's probably a good thing. So I had some redundancy money and I had to decide what to do. So I felt like I had to stay in gaming because I didn't know anything else really. And I was like, am I a gamer now? Am I like a woman in gaming? How did this happen? But like low level gaming as well, not like, you know.
Mario Kart.
It was weird because I sort of had this sort of weird niche again. I found myself in a weird niche where I didn't really know how that happened. So there was a job going at Sony for the launch of PlayStation 3, whatever that was in like 2005. And they were looking for an editor for their website. So they offered me the job as editor of the website, but it was a pay cut. And I was like, do I want to get any further into the gaming world? And then a guy that I worked with in that company knew somebody that worked in TV, and they happened to be out for a drink one night. And she said, oh, I'm doing this new panel show. We're looking for new writers, and I quite like to find some women. I think the general feeling was that they had female guests on and they would quite like some women to write for the female guests. And he said, oh, a girl I work with, she would be really good at that. And he gave her my name. And then they contacted me, and yeah, they sent me questions from the show because they would do sort of gag packs in those days, quite big gag packs, so that when they had guests on, they could suggest them things, you know, little gags and stuff that they might want to say, just short things.
Yeah.
There was quite a lot of writing on the show. So they just sent it to me and I just thought, oh, this is fun. And also it was a little bit like the sort of stuff I was doing at Play Jam, like silly little wordplay. And it was just sort of I just found it fun. So I spent quite a lot of time. They said, just do a day. But I didn't. I did way longer than that. I was like, I want to make this really good.
Sure.
And I wasn't getting paid or anything. It was just, they just wanted to see if I could do it, basically. So I spent loads of time doing it. And then I sent it back. And they were like, oh, we really like this. They came back to me and said, oh, that was good. Can you do another day? And I was like, yes, I can. So I did more. And then they offered me like a day a week, you know, not much money. I got like 150 quid or something.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, this is fun. But I didn't really think much about it at that stage. I didn't really think, oh, this is a normal job. I just thought it's just a thing that's happening now and they need some material. And
right.
So they just kept sort of phoning me and going, can you do another day? And I was like, yeah, I'll do another day. And then they started to say, can you come in the office? So I went in the office and I would do work at a desk in the office. And then that's when it started to snowball, really. I think Dave Spikey was one of the team captains at that point on 8 Out of 10 Cats.
Okay.
I mentioned that this was 8 Out of 10 Cats.
No.
I don't know if I did.
No, okay.
No, well, it was 8 Out of 10 Cats that they were making. So they'd already made one series. I didn't do the first series. And then the second series, I started to do a little bit of stuff. And then they were getting quite a lot of commissions for it. They were doing a couple of series a year. So, yeah, I started to write for the team captains then, and it was Dave Spikey. And I was writing stuff, sending it to the AP and the researcher, and they were emailing it to Dave Spikey. And she sent me an email one day, and she was really laughing because he'd replied to her and said, I don't know who's writing these jokes for me, but can you get him to write me some more?
All right, yeah.
And she said it to me. She was like, I think you're a man. And that's when I sort of thought, oh, okay, that's interesting. You know, I've sort of been brought on so I can write for the female guests, but because Dave had a very specific voice, comedy voice, that is, not being from Bolton.
Yes. Yeah.
I could hear whether something would fit for him to say or not when I was writing it. And I'd be like, oh, this sounds like something Dave would say.
Right.
And so that's when I started to think, okay, it doesn't really matter who I'm writing for, as long as I can hear it in their voice and try and imagine them saying it, then I'm going to get closer to material they're likely to want. And it doesn't matter if I'm writing for a man or a woman, as long as I can stay in that mindset.
Gauge their tone of voice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then he left, and then Jason Manford started, and I started writing for Jason. And Jason, again, has got a very specific voice and style. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to apply what I learned writing for Dave Spikey to Jason, you know, try and make sure I keep it in Jason's world. And and that worked well. And then that's when they started to say to me, Jimmy Carr wants to know if you'll go in the writer's room. And I was like, what? So I was quite happy being on my laptop on my own, thinking, you know, just that's how I'd always done it. And the writer's room looked so terrifying to me. It's this tiny little room in the corner, and you would just hear gales and gales of laughter coming out of there. It was all guys. And in those days, in that writer's room was like Sean Pye, Fraser Steele, Frankie Boyle, Charlie Brooker, you know, Neil Webster, just Jimmy, who I now know are all lovely, lovely, nice people. And it's fine. But then
it's going to be intimidating, isn't it?
You would hear these bellows of laughter coming out there, and I'd just be like, you're not sending me in there, are you?
Is it into the gallows? Yeah.
And they were, Ruth Phillips, she's like the director of Zeppotron now. Then she was like, the producer of 8 out of 10 Cats. She's so lovely. She's really mentored me and helped me over the years. And she's got such a lovely manner about her. She's got such a lovely, she knows how to talk to people and convince them to do things. And you don't even know that she's convinced you to do it.
Right.
She's got some voodoo that she does. And she just had she was like, it'll be fine. You just go in there, just do a day, you know, we'll see how you feel at the end of it. So I went in there and I was just like, oh my God, it was just mental, because they'd all known each other for like 15 years.
Yeah, yeah. So you've come in as an outsider.
It's so different being funny in front of people you know. You know, they all had shared in jokes and backstories, and, you know, and I just didn't know any of the references. And I was just like, and they're so quick. They were like laser quick. And you were just like, oh. And then it would take you ages to build up the courage to say something.
How long did you say something on your first session with them, or did it take you a few?
I tried to write some jokes before I went in, and then just have them in my back pocket so I could just go. Whoosh. And they weren't particularly good, but they were nice to me. You know, they weren't like, ooh, boo, get out.
Yeah.
But they were just like, that's okay. You know, but I was just like, oh, that wasn't a laugh. That was a sort of.
Right.
So yeah, it was when I came out the room, I was like a bit shell-shocked and a bit like, oh god. And I was trying to say to Ruth, that's not how I can be funny. I feel so stressed in there.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And it's not their fault. They're not being mean to me.
No.
I just feel really stressed that I'm around all these people that just know each other and know what makes each other laugh, and I don't. I feel like I'm not saying anything.
So how did you get around that?
Well, that's when Ruth said, Jimmy does want you to go back in. What you can do is take in the laptop and you can be the scribe in the room. So you can, and I know James touched on this a bit, but for me, that was a game changer because you had the security of the laptop.
So
you could write things down. If you had a joke and you just thought, I can't say it, I'm not confident enough to be thrown this in with Frankie Boyle and Charlie Brooker. I might just write this down. You could type it in. And then when Jimmy read the jokes later, sometimes he would read a joke that you'd written and he'd be like, oh, I like that. And you'd be like, you could learn sometimes without having to, because I'm not a performer in any shape or form. I don't know how people get up on stage and do comedy. I think it's so hard. And I just, it's not for me. And so, you know, even having to, you know, say jokes out in front of people in a room when you first start is, well, I don't know. I think some people have that sort of confidence. And, you know, that took me a bit of time, I think, particularly because of how good the people, you know, if I was in a writer's room, the people that weren't very good, I think I probably would have felt a bit better, but they were the best people. Perfect.
Hello, sorry to interrupt in the middle of this insightful conversation, which I'm enjoying, I'm sure, just as much as you are. But I need to give you guys a little reminder. If you like this conversation, this episode, if you like balancing acts in general, then please do subscribe to us, rate and review us, because it makes the world of difference. And the more reviews we get, the more rates we get, the more people can discover the podcast and we can make it go viral, whatever that means. Okay, back to the chat.
That's a serious baptism of fire, isn't it, going in? It's your first writer's room with those guys. And so looking, I mean, you went in there at that time and you were the only female gag writer. In terms of where the industry is at right now, do you feel that there's still very much sort of a lack of women and minority groups in writer's room? And if so, are there strategies that are starting to be put in place to change that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I didn't see any female writers in the shows. I was like, I'm not, you know, occasionally somebody would come into the room, but normally they would be comedy actresses or stand-ups that sort of wanted to. I think there's a two-pronged thing here. I think, yes, definitely women and minorities are underrepresented in rooms. Absolutely, 100%. I definitely think that's changing. I think more people are realizing that it is a job and that it exists, and so therefore more people are trying to get into it. Mm-hmm. And that in itself means there's more diversity. And I think shows are more aware now that they don't want a room that's just full of 45-year-old white men.
Yeah.
Because it's not beneficial to the show either. Mm-hmm. But I do think we have to give it a bit of time to change. I think saying overnight is going to be hard because, you know, because of the way the industry has been, the people with the most experience, it's difficult to say, oh, we're going to staff this room with people with lots of experience that have never really done it before. So we need to have a better training system, bringing people in and giving people the chance to learn how to write jokes and learn what works for TV. Because some people just come in going, well, I'm funny or I'm a stand-up and I know jokes. And it's like, but they have their own voice and it doesn't necessarily... It's not necessarily the same as writing. You know, I've been in rooms with absolutely brilliant, brilliant stand-up comedians, but they're not very good at writing for other people because they have their own voice and they haven't, you know, I mean, some people do it really well. Like Jeff Norcott's very good at it. I'm not saying that all stand-ups can't write for other people. Obviously, some of them do it all the time. Mm-hmm. But it's a false thought process to think that you have to have been a stand-up comedian in order to be a writer for other people. For me, it's a bit of the other way around, because if you don't have your own voice and you don't have your own way of structuring jokes and set, you can change all of that each time you write for somebody new.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And now I've forgotten what your original question was.
I was just talking about whether there's been a change in terms of representation of
I know ITV have been doing this comedy 50-50 thing. Okay. I did a little talk there once, and that's trying to not commission shows that don't have a 50-50, you know, male female writing rooms. And
yeah, do you think that's a good thing?
I do. As I say, it's going to take a bit of time because people need to be trained, and there aren't that many women that have had a lot of experience. So it becomes a catch 22, because you want experienced people, but then you look at the most experienced people and you're like, oh, a lot of them are guys.
Right.
So really you need a mixed writer's room, really, of more experienced people and less experienced people. Mm-hmm. Then the less experienced people can learn from the more experienced people, and you can have a more diverse room.
Yeah.
Because what you don't want is to just start a room full of new people, because I've been that new person and we don't know what we're doing.
Yeah, yeah. Sitting there terrified.
We don't know what we're doing.
Yeah.
You have to learn from people that know, that have been doing it for a long time, and then you'll get better quicker. The show won't suffer because it's got loads of inexperienced people on it. But you're also bringing in new people, you know, from different backgrounds, you know, from all different backgrounds, because you don't, you just don't want a room that's just staffed with Oxbridge people.
For sure. Over the years, was there someone in particular that you felt was a mentor to you in terms of saying, oh, that was great, but maybe try doing this differently, or in terms of like the way that you structure your joke?
Well, Ruth Phillips at Zebricon was 100% that person.
Right, okay.
You know, because the stuff I was doing for 8 out of 10 cats, it was sort of missing word type stuff. So they'd say, you know, one of the questions would be like, oh, what is, a lot of it's based on statistics things. So it'd be like, what is, have you frozen again? Have I frozen?
No, I'm just, it's me. It's my concentration phase. Sorry. Yeah.
So it'd be like 80% of pensioners do what on a Sunday? And people would have to come up with, you know, funny words that might be in there. So then Ruth said to me, can you write topical jokes? And I was like, I have no idea. Which I think if I would, you know, if I was a public school guy, I would have gone, yeah, right. I can.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, I didn't. I went, confidence. I don't know.
Yeah.
I really don't know if I can, because I just got to be honest about it. I don't want to be in a position where I've said I can do something that I can't do.
Yeah, I get that.
So I was like, maybe I can. I've never written them before. And she was like, okay, well, go away, write some, go away. Write some and then come back and we'll go through them.
Mm-hmm.
So we did. I remember we sat in the cafe downstairs in at the Endemol building in Shepherd's Bush. And we sat in the bar and I gave her some stuff that I'd written and she went through it and she was like, well, this one, no one would ever say that on television ever in a million years. This one, that's quite good. This one, really good. That works. This one, no. And just went through and I was like, okay, so more like that, less like that. That's a definite no. That's too long. And so you sort of start to get an idea of
what works,
you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I work best with very honest direction.
Mm.
You know, I like mm-hmm. it. Someone says that doesn't work. That does work. More of that, less of that. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't need to be sort of
mollycoddled and sort of given sort of.
Yeah. I like thing. To know what's good and what's not good. And yeah. then I can move from there. And I'm good at learning by that way. And so I'll go, okay, these are no, these are yes, these are no, these are yes, you know. And in the same way that I'll watch back stuff that I've done
yeah.
on TV and I'll see what's made the edit,
mm-hmm.
because just because something's got in the final script, that's only gets you so far. Has this made the edit, you know? Why has that joke made the edit and that one not?
Is, and it's disappointing? Not always because, you know, is it disappointing when you see that your jokes don't make the edit, or maybe they get changed beyond recognition?
Not really. Not if it works. If someone changes a joke and it makes it better, then great.
Okay. Yeah.
If they change a joke and make it worse, you just feel a bit. You're just a bit like, what have you done that for?
Mm. Will you ever say?
You know.
Will you ever confront someone and say, why did you do that? You're shit. It was funny before.
I mean, I would if it was a producer.
Okay.
Particularly if I know them, I'd yeah. be like, why did you do that? You ruined right. it.
Yeah.
But not the host. No, because the host has to. The host has to change something to make them comfortable with it. So sometimes they will change a joke and you think it was better before, but they have to make it in a way that makes them happy and happy to say it. And if that change means that they can sell that joke better, or, you know, they're just more comfortable with it, then that's their choice. And, you know, there's no point in telling them they've done it wrong, because yeah. that's my opinion and they might prefer it the other way. And they're the one that's what I always say. They have to get up and say those words in front of people. So they have to have confidence in it. And they have to, you know, they have to go, okay, I'm happy to say this, rather than just saying something that you've written that they're not particularly comfortable with. And then if it goes wrong, they'll be like, whereas if they change it and it goes wrong, at least you can sort of go, oh,
yeah.
Could you move the important words around?
Yeah, yeah, they were there for a reason. There's a certain rhythm. Jazz. It was back to my jazz days. It's probably not going to make sense because I feel like we talked about it on recording. But anyway, do you find that there is a specific segment of time where casual chat needs to ensue in a writer's room before you take part in any writing? And if so, what do you feel is the average length of casual chat that needs to occur before everybody is comfortable enough to start getting down to business?
An hour, 10 till 11, casual chat.
Really? And so if you're somebody who's not akin or comfortable to comfortable chatting, then you're going to find it hard, would you say? If you're somebody who's just like, they just want to knuckle down and get to it, it's not for them.
Well, that's fine. And it depends on, you know, who you know in the room. If it's people you know, it's always good to have an hour's chat in the morning.
About just the world, you know, and news and things that are going on that potentially could be good material, or just about what happened last night and what you ate for dinner?
Not so much that. A little bit of that, maybe, what people have been up to. But yeah, a good chat about the news, things you've seen in the news, funny things, you know.
Do you find it's important to be very well read in terms of keeping up to date with the news on a daily basis, reading lots of different types of newspapers so that you're aware of what's going on?
I'm not one of those people that's like, I don't read that newspaper. I can't be dealing with that attitude. Yeah. Can't be dealing with that. Well, I only read The Guardian. It's like, what are you talking about? You know, I understand the reasons why people dislike a lot of the tabloids. I understand the reasons why people don't like the Mail and the Sun. I get it.
Yeah.
But the Mail and the Sun are very useful when it comes to joke writing because they incorporate a lot of funny detail a lot of the time. And, you know, they've been invaluable to me writing jokes over the years.
I can imagine.
I mean, if you're in a room and they're leaving and they say you can only have two newspapers in here to write jokes from, I would say the Mail and the Sun. Don't leave me the Financial Times.
No, try as.
You know, the Telegraph is just not as much use to, when it comes to joke writing, as the Sun and the Mail.
Yeah.
Because they're ridiculous papers. And I'm not saying that you learn a lot of news, and I'm not saying that their attitudes are great, but the sentences they use and the detail that they put into stories, really, really useful when it comes to joke writing.
Yeah.
And also, it's good to read different opinions, because if you're reading different opinions, then you can decide what angle you can use to formulate a joke. If you don't know what other people are saying, you don't know what's on the other side of that coin, how can you make a joke about it?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, I'm sure that lots of people are like, we're not having the Mail or the Sun in the writer's room. And it's like, okay, but...
wasn't that the issue recently that, you know, Have I Got News of You accused of being too leftist? But with that, they're just taking the piss out of the current government. So didn't really.
Well, exactly. I always find that with the BBC, that the left say that the BBC's too right wing and the right say that it's too left wing. So it's like, well, then it's doing its job, isn't it? Because it's impartial. What you're saying is it's in the middle. It's a bit of both.
Yeah. Having worked, you've worked on so many different panel shows and talk shows and, you know, award shows. What's been your, in terms of your experience of working with celebs, how's your sort of your view of the notion of being a celebrity? I don't know. Has it changed? Have you witnessed it affecting people's behavior in different ways?
Yes. Some people deal with fame really well and don't let it change how they treat people. And some people don't. Some people just get sucked right into it. And
you see that change in them, from like coming onto a panel show or something early doors, and then a year down the line, they've blown up. You're just like, oh, fuck, you've become a right arsehole.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah. And so some people are
weird.
Like, you know.
It must be a weird thing to see that change. And, you know, you see someone is a certain way, it might be like quite normal, well adjusted, and then suddenly just switch.
Yeah, it's a shame because you're just like, oh, you've drunk the Kool-Aid. It's that switch really where they suddenly think that they're better.
Right.
They're better than everyone else. And then they're more important. And it's like, I can't be dealing with that at all. I really hate it. It's like, I get it. You know, you need to do certain things differently because, you know, you're in the public eye. I understand. But, you know, we're all just people.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just completely unnecessary.
How's it dealt with?
I mean, some of my favourite people.
Yeah.
Someone like, I love Alan Carr so much. I just think he is just the embodiment of, he is how you imagine he would be when you see him on TV.
Uh-huh.
He's so lovely and friendly. And, you know, he would happily sit and have a drink with you. And you don't feel that, you don't feel that he actually wants to go off and talk to somebody famous. You know, you don't. Yeah. You do feel like that with some people. You feel like, oh, they're saying hello, but really they want to go and talk to somebody more important than me.
Mm.
Whereas Alan never makes you feel like that. He always makes you feel like he's having a laugh with you, and he's just a nice person. And you feel relaxed around him, and then you feel that you can, you know, be funnier because
as a result you can do your best work. Okay, so we've talked a lot about career stuff outside of writing. What do you do, Christine, to unwind and relax? I know, obviously, granted, this year has been quite different, but in general, what have you always done to take your mind off things? Or are you somebody that's always thinking about the gags?
I mean, I like being funny. I like being around funny people. I like making people laugh. I like people making me laugh. So that's always something that's happening.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's even when I'm trapped at home, we have our, you know, like everyone else, we have our like WhatsApp groups for, you know, a writer's room. You know, we sort of try and keep the writer's room going on WhatsApp, and we'll do topical jokes and,
that's good,
you know, back and forth like we're in the room. So those are particularly over the last year have been really invaluable, really.
Yeah,
just
imagine.
Knowing that you can still, you've got that outlet, really. You need that sort of outlet to, because otherwise, you know, which is another reason why I couldn't be in a normal corporate world, I don't think, because you don't have that outlet for this sort of madness that of always trying to find the funny thing to say, or always, you know, where my focus is, even in sort of serious situations.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a curse sometimes. People are like, do you mind? And I'm like, sorry. What do I do? Well, I've certainly started exercising more. I find that's really necessary because it's such a sedentary job. I'm like a long distance lorry driver.
Yeah.
I just don't move around much in the day. And some people I know when they're working from home can, like, some writers I know have to go and do things. So someone I know goes to the gym and like write stuff down while they're in the gym. They'll put stuff on their phone and, you know, that's their way of kind of, but I can't do that. If I go to the gym in the middle of the day, I'll just get distracted.
Mm.
You know, I need to sit and focus.
Yeah.
And so you just do so much sitting down, and it's not good for you.
So exercise, you're finding useful.
A lot more exercise. I'm also learning a language.
Ooh,
like an asshole.
What languages are you, or what language are you learning, or have been learning?
Well, my boyfriend's Italian, and his family don't speak a lot of English. So when we go to Italy,
where in Italy are they from?
Modena, so northern Italy, sort of near Bologna.
Oh yeah.
And it's really interesting because for me, you know, meeting lots of new people and his friends and stuff, when I first met them, you know, what I consider my superpower, being able to make people laugh and, you know, in order to get along with them and for them to think I'm, you know, fun, gets taken away when you've got that language barrier.
Yeah.
And so one of his friends said to me something like, I like you, even though you don't speak. And I was like, I do speak. So it's just,
is it a compliment? Like, oh yeah, I guess so.
He just thinks I'm just this like mute woman. Even his
with
niece,
a very friendly face.
His niece, and I met her, she was like 5. She was really excited to meet me. And then she was really disappointed that I was this like mute lady and didn't say anything.
Yeah.
And she's like talking in my face in Italian. And I'm just like, I don't understand any of this. And the look on her face is literally like, the fuck is she? What is this that you brought me?
Yeah.
This
I had the same experience. I had the same experience. I was going out with an Italian girl, and I went to meet their family in Naples, and couldn't speak a word of English.
I see.
Yeah, it was serious spicy. Serious spicy. And hence the relationship no longer existing. But
you're still alive though. So.
I'm still alive. No, I need to tell the story. Currently turning into a script, but it's a funny feeling, isn't it? Like, it makes you feel a bit like a kid, like an awkward kid. You can't communicate properly. It's like it's football was the one thing I had. Football, that was it. Because they had a few names. Maradona. Maradona, because he's, you know.
I talk a lot about food.
Food and football, always, the two Fs.
I'm always just, I just say I like things a lot, or I really like things, or talk about food and how delicious it is.
Yeah.
And I hate it. I hate how hampered I am and how nobody really knows my real personality, because you're just constantly, you know, stuck in this mid ground of just trying to explain basic things. They're trying to explain basic things to me, and then they're all laughing about something, and I'm trying to get my boyfriend to explain it to me, and he's like, it's quite complicated, and I'm like, okay.
The worst. Yeah, funny person.
His mum was saying loads of stuff in Italian, and she was talking, and then I said to my boyfriend, what was that, what did she say? And he went, oh, you know, just some mum stuff. And I'm like, no, you got to tell me what the mum is. You can't just go, just some mum stuff. I need to know what it is.
They do say a lot of words, though, that it seems like they're saying a lot for quite something that's actually quite succinct. You know, like a 10-minute sentence could just be like, what are we having for lunch? Which I love. I mean, it's so expressive. It's an expressive language. Are you using, which things are you learning? Are you doing it via Duolingo or anything like that? Are you doing this?
Well, I've got Duolingo, but also I was doing a course at City Lit.
Oh, you went in.
COVID.
Okay.
So I went in and that was going quite well. But then it sort of starts to get away from you because you're like, I'm all over this. Yeah, I'll be a chair. And then the next thing you know, it's like really complicated past tense things.
Oh,
like,
that's where it gets. That's where I tripped up.
It just started to like just escalate away from me, and I was like, oh. And then COVID happened, and then it was all on Zoom. So then you're on a Zoom call with the teacher and like 15 other people, and then some people are really much worse than you, and some people are much better than you, and you're just sort of in the middle. And then he kept putting you in breakout rooms with random people you didn't know, and you had to have a conversation. And you're like, well, they can't speak, I can't speak, I don't know if what they're saying is right.
Yeah.
So I had the last one in September, and I was like, I don't think this is working for me anymore. So I had a big break from it, and then I'm now panicking that we're gonna have to go to Italy at some point, and they're gonna expect my Italian to be much better, and it's gonna be worse, and they're gonna be like, this woman is an idiot. I've just started with my agent, actually, whose mum is Italian, and she wants to learn Italian, so we're now having like private tuition on Zoom through iTalki.
Oh yeah, it's good.
Yeah, so we found a woman on there, and we had yesterday we had like a tester lesson with her, and she's really nice. Catarina from Puglia.
Yeah, just make sure you don't do what I did, where I just sort of like, no, she's good, but I'm just going to try one more, and I went through about 20 different teachers having like one lesson each. And doing the same lesson over again.
Yeah, we like her. She's nice.
Yeah, commit.
She's friendly. She's patient.
That's what you want.
Me and my agent had the same thing where we're like, we don't want to feel like we're being bullied. We don't want somebody, because I had this teacher once who was like quite an old Italian guy, and he was just sort of pissed off with you all the time if you couldn't remember the last lesson.
It's
like, I'm a grown up. I don't want to feel that I'm learning through fear.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you're going to be pissed off with me and get angry because I can't remember the word for vegetables.
Yeah. Food's the one. I said, start with food and you go from there. As long as I know my food, then that's at least a starting point. I'm all right with that.
Yeah. I need to have some basic chat. But yeah, but sometimes also I'll try. Last time I was there, I got a bit brave and I started to do some speaking. And I was trying to explain something to one of his friends, and it was obviously so bad that his friend just went to me, just say it in English. Just say it in English. He was just couldn't bear to listen to me mangling his language. Just say it in English. So, yeah. I'll understand.
So destroying, like, isn't it?
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
Scusa.
Scusa.
Yeah.
Mi dispiace.
I spent a lot of my time going, mi dispiace.
And there's there's batuda and batada, the difference between that. I got that terribly wrong. Batuta is joke. It's a joke. And batada is whore.
Like killing your family. Oh, whore.
Yeah, yeah. So I called her mum a whore the first time I met her. Which luckily they had a sense of humour. They had a sense of humour. But anyway, okay, so languages. And do you read are you a book reader? Are you a fan of reading audio, because the question is going to be, are there any books over the years that have inspired you in some way?
I do read. I'm a bit weird with things that I like to read, really. I mean, in terms of comedy, I always go back to the Seinfeld scripts.
Did you buy a book with all the scripts?
It's called the Seinfeld scripts, and it's like a big compilation of all the scripts, and it's just an amazing read.
Genius.
It's just lovely to just see it all written down. And I really enjoy that. I liked Rob Long's book, Conversations with My Agent.
I don't know that.
Rob Long is a writer. He wrote on Cheers.
Okay.
It's an interesting look into sort of the American system. And he was, he was one of the writers on Cheers. And then you get sort of staffed. Like, you know, I was saying they're obsessed with staffing people. So even though you're not working on a show, if you've worked on something big like that, they might staff you at a studio and basically hope that you'll come up with a good idea. Right. So they would like to sort of pay you to be around writing stuff and having ideas in the hope that it might turn into something. And then if it doesn't, they sort of let you go. And then it was just a sort of strange system. And then it sort of intercut with him having like phone conversations with his agent, and his agent kind of, you know, who sounds a little bit like Joey's agent in Friends, quite straight talking. And I thought it was interesting. And he's funny. He's very funny. I like to read a lot of books about nutrition, weirdly. Okay. I just find them very interesting. So I've read a lot of sort of the Spoonful, I think, was, and recently read Spoonful and Why We Eat Too Much in brackets, and Gut, that was very good. That's sort of, it's just something I'm interested in, really.
Do you read those and you like, you incorporate some of the tips for like a week or so and then just fall off the wagon? Or do you just stay with them?
I sort of did for a bit, but what I found was I needed to take a more kind of holistic approach and to sort of incorporate, instead of doing incorporating one thing and then after a couple of weeks going, well, that doesn't do anything, trying to incorporate lots of them so that the collective, you know, one thing on its own, yeah, probably doesn't do a lot, but if you incorporate lots of them, so now it's something that I'm sort of sticking to.
But then if you do,
slightly obsessed with gut bacteria.
If you do a lot of them at the same time, how do you know which one's working then?
Well, I think that's sort of the point, really. You incorporate as many as you can, and then you just see if you feel better. You know, I think I don't think one thing on its own does make a big difference. But that's how the human body works. It has to be lots of different things coming together. You know.
So, what's your game changers? Which ones have you done? You think, or like a combo of things that you think, oh yeah, I feel much better for this.
Oh, well, recently I've just felt so much better. I'm not eating a lot of grains.
Okay.
Without meaning to get all Gwyneth Paltrow on your ass. And because that's the thing, I'll never tell anyone else what to eat or, you know, I think it's very specific to you, and you have to try different diets and different things until you find a way of, I needed a way of eating that works for me and doesn't make me feel terrible.
Yeah.
I think especially as you get older and you can't process alcohol as well, and I was just feeling shit all the time. Lack of motivation, tired, difficult to write because your brain's foggy. So drinking a lot of sort of, you know, consuming a lot of fermented things, so like kombucha, kefir, things like that, yogurt, not eating a lot of grains, that's really helped me not be all fuzzy all the time.
So like cereal and rice and...
Yeah. Just makes me really tired.
Mm,
so I'm good with meat, I'm good with dairy. Mm-hmm. I just can't eat a lot of, you know, even my boyfriend, who obviously likes pasta, is like, yeah, we need to maybe not eat so much pasta. It just makes me so tired and just, a lot of exercise, cold showers.
I love a cold shower. You're doing cold showers in the mornings?
Cold showers, yeah. Every day I'm doing cold showers. Even if I have a hot one first and then end it with, so at first I was doing like 20 seconds and I was like going to die. And now I could do like, I could have a full cold shower now.
Is this Wim Hof? Are you doing it off the back of that?
Yeah, like minor Wim Hof. I'm not getting into large ice buckets. Although once you start getting used to the feeling of the cold showers, it's like, actually.
It's addictive, isn't it?
How mad would it be if you were like getting in ice buckets? I bet you feel amazing afterwards.
Yeah.
I want to do that cryotherapy chamber thing where you go in there. I think that'd be amazing.
Yeah.
Like that's what I mean. I think like, I'm taking Simproof as well. That
Simproof.
Yeah, it's like you know, you get like Actimel and things like that with the live bacteria in.
Yeah.
Well, and Yakult and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they're all rubbish because they don't survive your stomach acid.
Okay.
So they just don't get to where they need to get to. Whereas Simproof survives your stomach acid, and so it gets down to where it needs to get down to. So it's like live bacteria, and you're like repopulating your gut because they're a lot of the research now is saying that lots of disease and depression and, you know, problems we have come from your gut and not having enough gut bacteria, not having enough friendly bacteria. You know, people have been talking about it for years, but this is one of the first companies that's actually developed something that can survive
there. Sin as in like and, a sin proof.
Sim, S-Y-M.
S-Y-M.
Yeah, they were farmers and they were noticing that their cattle were like not well because the food that they were giving them was like just sort of cattle feed wasn't good. And these young calves were sick. And so they developed this like germinated barley and were giving it to the calves and they were just all surviving and really thriving. And they were like, well, there's something in this. And then they started to do kind of trials on it. And the medical world started getting interested and going, hang on a minute, what's going on here? So they've been doing a lot of trials and testing. And
yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
It's like you said, I was like, I don't want to get all Gwyneth Paltrow on. I totally get that. But if these things make you feel good, then that affects your creativity, means you can have a better output. And also you can, more importantly, carry on breathing and living.
Well, that's the thing. Nice. It's like if you just do a cold shower, you might feel a bit better. But if you change your diet and you try and sort out your gut bacteria and you do a cold shower and you do a sauna and you do all these things together, those things can make quite a big difference. And that's what I've noticed. I just feel a lot better. I mean, I can't give up drinking because I'm at heart, a very, very accomplished alcoholic. Yeah. But, you know, I'm trying to sort of manage it a bit. And because the older I get, the more my hangovers just really make working just
horrendous, isn't it? Yeah, no, I feel that. Okay, a final question I'm going to ask you, Christine, is what does the idea of balance mean to you or not?
Well, all the things we've just discussed is quite a good thing of like, but that's a lot of that's just due to getting older, I think. And like I said, having a sedentary job and, you know, trying to, you know, not feel terrible every day. I mean, in terms of work, I think just trying to, because this job is so up and down, you know, which is why it's also not a job for everybody, because if you have a lot of anxiety about where your next pay packet is coming from, it can be quite stressful because you have low points where there is just no work around. And then you have high points where you're working a lot and you have to be able to ride through the quiet times and be confident that, you know, more work's going to come. Because I wouldn't have got to I would have given up a long time ago if I started to get stressed about there being no work for 2 months, because it just happens. Particularly over the summer, it can be very quiet.
Mm.
So just being at peace with the fact that you're going to be working a lot and then you're not going to be working, and then you're going to be working a lot and then you're not going to be working. And, you know, it's all right. And if that month period of no work turns into a year, then yeah, maybe you've got a problem.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to kind of, if you want to do this for a job, you have to be comfortable in the highs and lows. And, you know, I think Sean touched on this in his as well, saying that just take all the opportunities that come to you.
Mm-hmm. So because yes to everything.
Even when I was doing those early days on 8 out of 10 cats, that wasn't enough money for me to live on.
Yeah.
So I had to do other jobs at the same time. So I did a lot of website stuff. Me and my friend used to do like an agony aunt column where he gave the male perspective and then I gave the female perspective. We wanted to call ourselves Richard and Moody, but we weren't allowed for some reasons. I don't know what we were called in the end. Can't remember. It was for Yahoo or something. We used to do it every week and it was just a bit of fun and they paid us. I used to be the editor of the Big Brother website at this heyday.
So yeah, there was lots of stuff.
Yeah. And to me, yeah. Big Brother was like, you know, it was still television. I wasn't writing on screen, but we were doing the website, which was, you know, one of the biggest, most looked at websites in Europe at that time. It was just huge.
Yeah.
And the newspapers used to take our stories and just cut and paste them, put them together and put their own byline on them, you know. So
right.
Those were mental times because they ran it like a newsroom. So it was like 24 hours it was being staffed. And we used to do shift work.
That's going to be a good training ground, I'd imagine. Great training.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it wasn't comedy in a sense, but, you know, we tried to make some of the stories funny and then we do video clips for the website and, you know, you would have to, it was good to have a sort of comedy, a humorous angle on some of them as well. You know, not all the videos were going to be massive fights. Some of them would be funny stuff and So, you know, it was interesting. And it was also an interesting way to learn how television works.
Yep.
And reality TV and you know, all those people that worked on that. I've worked with various people over the years. Again, you know, I recently did a quiz show with Sharon Powers, who used to be a big cheese at Big Brother. So, you know, even sort of these side jobs that you think, okay, this isn't writing for a chat show, or this isn't necessarily what I want to do. It's all, you know,
you learn something. You never know who you're going to meet along the way, and where that's going to, you know, lead to at some point. Christine, thank you for that answer. And where can people keep up to date with what you're up to? Do you do the social medias, or do you stay well away?
I mean, I'm on Twitter, but you know, I'm just guffing about. I think the problem is, if I've got good jokes, I've got already somewhere to.
You've got your home for them. Yeah.
I've got homes for them.
Sure.
So I can't put, you know, I don't have the funniest Twitter in the world. It's just, you know, me. There are other people that, you know, don't do my job and have funnier Twitter accounts than me. But, you know, if I've got something really good, I often don't feel like I can't waste this on Twitter. I've got somewhere, I've got homes for these.
Yeah.
So Twitter ends up being just like, well, yeah. And every now and again, I'll just put up a half thought and, you know, someone will quite like it. But it does sort of suit me that, you know, the sort of short form, you know, that's sort of what I learned in with Jimmy, you know, in those writers' rooms.
Yeah.
Take out all the unnecessary words, and if you can get to the joke as quickly as possible. You know, some people don't like that. You know, some people like a longer joke and a more chat around. You know, someone like Jason Manford would like more of a chat around the joke than too much of a one-liner.
Yeah.
But if you can write a one-liner, then you can extrapolate back from that and make a longer version. But I've just done the film BAFTAs, and you know, that's a war. I mean, I could do a whole another podcast on award shows. They are just the craziest thing.
Yeah,
and I've done a lot of kind
onto
of
that, but yeah.
Yeah, they're just I was thinking about that yesterday, because it's jokes by committee, because you've got BAFTA, you've got BBC, you've got the production company, you've got the host, you know, everyone has an opinion on the jokes.
Hmm.
And you know, some of the conversations you end up having about the wording of a joke, it's just because, you know, BAFTA are worried about one thing, the BBC are worried about a whole nother set of things. You know, we're just trying to do some funny jokes. The host is trying to get through it without, you know, getting a load of shit. So it's just, it's a mad world. It really is a mad world. And, you know, it was Dermot and Edith this year. So, it was much more of a sort of TV presenter vibe, because obviously they're not comedians, but they still did a really good job. It's so hard. It's a really hard thing to do. And not many people could do it, I don't think. But I did love writing for Graham Norton on it. He's just fantastic. Anyway, we should do a special on awards shows.
Yeah, we'll
I have
back.
A lot
we'll,
to say about
them. We'll revisit that.
Yeah.
So what's it, Twitter, where you're at on Twitter?
Well, I'm like Xteen, because I couldn't have Christine Rose.
Ah, okay.
Because I think there's an American actress called Christine Rose.
Yeah, there is.
Also, there's a trawler called Christine Rose, but I don't think they have a Twitter account.
Yeah, I did wonder whether before this.
Rose.
Sorry, at what?
Xteen, Xtine underscore Rose. I'm not on Instagram. I keep thinking I should get on Instagram. I'm quite scared of Instagram.
I've just I've deleted mine from my phone for now, and I've deleted Twitter from my phone, and I've deactivated
from
Facebook.
I'm not very good at taking pictures of things, and I think, well, if that's all you're doing,
yeah, you just end up scrolling for ages. I mean, it's a good pastime on the bog, that's for sure. But then, you know, you just end up wasting a long time, then you get pins and needles. So
I remember when I was doing X Factor, and writing, not I wasn't I'm not wasn't trying to launch a singing career, and. I was in the dressing rooms a lot, and with all the makeup artists and the stylists and stuff. And they just could not get their head around the fact that I wasn't on Instagram. They just didn't understand it. They were like, huh? They were like, but it's your CV. I was like, it's not my CV.
That's how it is.
It's not my CV. But they were just like, who wouldn't have an Instagram account, you weirdo, you old lady troll? Like, what's happening? I was like, I just thought I'm not great at taking pictures. And, you know, I get it if you own like a shoe company, but I suppose if you're a makeup artist and a stylist, you want to take pictures of the things.
Yeah, it's different. It's a more
like it makes sense.
Yeah, it's a more visual medium, I guess. So that is different.
Yeah, I was just sort of wondering how it would work for me on Instagram. You know, there'd be lots of pictures of kind of tired looking people in writers' rooms surrounded by packets of crisps and empty Costa cups.
Yeah.
And it's like, does anyone want to see that? Maybe.
Or just be pictures of Christine Rose the trawler. Just different
exactly.
The boat.
Exactly, the big boat.
Yeah,
the big niche, fish boat.
Niche profile. We can come back to this, but we'll revisit. We'll have to revisit a special episode of the
awards show special.
Yeah, yeah. And then we can also come back, revisit your Instagram, find out how you've got on, which route you decided to go down, or not at all, TBC. But thank you so much for coming on. It's been great talking with you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Perfect.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.